Hi, I'm Rebecca Davis.
And I'm April Fulton. This is Your Health, the weekly podcast from NPR's Science Desk.
We're back from spring vacation. Woo-hoo. But that doesn't mean we're going to spend our time just sitting around.
No way. This week, we've got two stories about the dangers of a sedentary lifestyle.
And some folks are fighting back and bringing treadmills to work, reports our health blog, Shots.
Which also reported this week that some school lunches might be getting a bit healthier.
And as we all know, child nutrition is a top priority for the White House, which now wants to limit the amount of advertising kids see for junk food every day. But as Ari Shapiro reports, it's also part of what White House critics see as a growing nanny state.
Some of the most memorable cartoons on television are less than 30 seconds long. For decades, Saturday mornings on TV have been populated by Count Chocula,
chocolatey cereal with chocolatey marshmallow bats,
Dig'em the Frog,
Kellogg's Sugar Snacks,
part of this nutritious breakfast,
Dig'em,
and Tony the Tiger.
Those big crisp flakes of corn with that secret toasted in sugar frosting, they're great!
Those ads have more in common than trippy cartoon mascots. Marshmallow bats, sugar smacks, toasted in sugar frosting. Stephen Terrett is a public health professor at Johns Hopkins University.
Your ability to recognize those characters is a function of how much money the food makers spent in trying to alter the behaviors of children in a non-healthful manner.
Now the Obama administration is offering what it calls voluntary principles to guide industry self-regulatory efforts to improve the nutritional profile of foods marketed to children. In other words, the government wants food manufacturers to spend less money advertising junk food to kids, not just on TV, but in every medium. It's a voluntary program, but it still rankles libertarians such as David Bowes of the Cato Institute, who doesn't want the government telling us what to eat for breakfast.
If the federal government decided to issue voluntary guidelines about what newsmen should say to avoid inflaming the public, I think you guys would be pretty upset.
Oh, we would just choose not to follow them. Can't food companies do the same thing?
Food companies could choose not to follow them, but every major company in America is subject to so many involvements with the federal government that it's very difficult to do.
Margot Wu-Tan hopes he's right. She's director of nutrition policy at the Center for Science in the Public Interest, and she helped write these standards. She says companies are already self-regulating ads for kids, but right now the system is a patchwork with lots of holes.
These standards take us from having self-regulation be a nice idea to having self-regulation actually work.
And the food industry says it's open to these proposals. Scott Faber is Vice President of Federal Affairs at the Grocery Manufacturers Association.
Government has a very big role to play if we are going to end childhood obesity within a generation, as the First Lady has called on us to do. So these are recommendations that we'll look at carefully as we think of ways to update the standards we're already using.
The public has 45 days to comment on these new proposals before the Obama administration sends its final report to Congress. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
Show us you're a tiger. Show us what you can do.
Big tiger.
The taste of Tony's fire takes place.
And she can't.
Bring out the tiger in you.
And you.
So, our health blogger, Scott Hensley, he's off on his own spring break this week, but we have Eliza Barkley with us, and she's been taking care of the blog in his absence. Hi, Eliza.
Hi, Rebecca.
Hello.
Hi, April. So, there were a couple of posts this week about children's nutrition.
Indeed. We started off with one on everybody's favorite celebrity chef, Jamie Oliver, who's back in the news again. He's never out for that long. And this week, he went on a television show, Jimmy Kimmel Live, to announce with the superintendent of the L.A. Unified School District that the school district will be getting rid of flavored milks.
What's so bad about chocolate milk?
Well, chocolate milk and strawberry milk and all these flavored milks have a lot of sugar. And Jamie Oliver has made a big stink about this recently. He, on his show, Jamie Oliver's Food Revolution, a couple weeks ago, he filled up a school bus with sugar, basically to make a point about all the sugar that kids are consuming. And so, yeah, he was able to apparently convince the school district to eliminate all these flavored milks and just replace them with regular old milk.
So, April, you also dealt with sort of the issue of school lunches this week in a post about farms. Local farms and school lunches, what was that?
Yeah, the U.S. Department of Agriculture published a rule that will encourage schools to partner with local farms and local food producers to get fresh fruits and vegetables and other kind of fresher local products into the school system. One of the problems right now is that it's quite hard to give contracting preference to smaller farms and produce mm-hmm. sections because the way the school lunch program is structured, it looks at commodities and mm-hmm. large organizations.
And they tend to be very centralized, don't they?
Yes.
So local schools aren't really able to do individual contracts or...
This gives them a little more flexibility in giving preference to local providers.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, and do we know yet if, you know, what this is really going to mean now that they can do it? Is it difficult to do? I mean, is there a sense that schools are really going to take them up on this?
I think so, because there are a lot of school districts that have been working pretty hard for the last couple years I've been hearing about that have wanted to partner with local farms and have found all these bureaucratic roadblocks. So this should make it a bit easier. We'll see.
Mm. Okay. All right. So I also saw a post this week with the title Medication in Motion. And we're back to motion. Eliza, you wrote that one, I believe.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. So these researchers in Boston decided to study the effects of Tai Chi, practicing Tai Chi with patients with heart failure.
And Eliza, when you say heart failure, what do you mean exactly?
Well, heart failure is a sort of a loose general term. It refers to a wide range of different chronic heart conditions, but it doesn't mean that you're bedridden. There are many people out there living with heart failure, moving on with life, but with significant problems. If you have heart failure, you tend not to do a lot of exercise. There's shortness of breath, all kinds of different symptoms associated with it. And another thing about heart failure is that people with it tend to be depressed and have kind of a gloomy outlook.
So what did they see happening to these people who were doing Tai Chi?
Well, the way they were able to measure the effects of Tai Chi was basically by giving people a questionnaire evaluating how they felt and their perception of their quality of life. And what was interesting was that the people who did this Tai Chi, and they had a control group that just did a regular heart education sort of session, and then they had another group that did Tai Chi, and the people who'd done the Tai Chi reported much higher levels of quality of life. So basically, they felt a lot better about their lives after doing this, and they felt their mood seemed to improve quite a bit. And so the researchers concluded that indeed Tai Chi is very beneficial for people with heart failure.
So exercise improves mood, clearly, and you also had a post about moving at work. Tell us about treadmill desks.
Well, a treadmill desk is basically what it sounds like. It's a desk that's built on top of a treadmill so that you're actually walking on the treadmill while you're working at your desk on your computer instead of sitting, basically. And I talked to a couple people who have them, one who bought one and one who built one in his home.
How do they read while on a treadmill? I find this very difficult. I mean, your magazine, the words are kind of jumping all around. You're looking at a page and it's jumping.
Well, interestingly enough, what they recommend is that you actually walk very slowly on these treadmill desks, slower than you would normally. The average person walks about 3 miles an hour. They suggest walking about 1 mile an hour while you're working. So apparently it's not that hard to read email, type, read things on the internet and talk on the phone while you're walking at that pace.
But maybe not do a few other things like cropping pictures and stuff.
Indeed. One guy I spoke to, David Goldenberg, he works on web-based stuff, and he mentioned that he had a hard time with his hand-eye coordination cropping photos using a mouse. And also studies have shown that, indeed, walking while working can affect your mouse performance.
Okay, a little caution there.
Yes.
Thanks a lot, Eliza.
Sure.
Thank you.
I got a new way to walk.
Now, two more stories about the dangers of inactivity. First, chronic sitting. We all know that being physically active is good for you, but now researchers are finding that even if you exercise regularly, sitting all day can still cause health problems. Patty Naiman reports.
Danielle Osby says the best birthday gift ever was her bicycle. Co-workers chipped in to surprise her about this time last year, a brilliant colored cruiser.
She's green, sassy, and good for you.
So after being mostly sedentary for years, Osby now bikes back and forth to work about 10 miles a day.
I'm not the one that kind of like monitors myself on the scale constantly, but I've dropped a nice amount of weight.
And at 41, Osby's blood pressure's good, her cholesterol's low, and she's successfully battling a family history of hypertension and diabetes. All good, but with one hitch. Like many of us, when Osby's not sleeping or biking, she's often working, and as she says, completely handcuffed to her desk.
There's a progress report due, or there's grants due, or some other deadline. The time kind of flies by while you're sitting at the computer, sitting.
Researchers are now beginning to suspect that even though Osby exercises every day, it may not be enough to counteract the hazards of all that sitting. Because when you add it all up, epidemiologist Stephen Blair says it's a lot more sitting than moving.
Let's say you do 30 minutes of walking 5 days a week. And let's say you sleep for 8 hours. Well, that still leaves 15 and a half hours. Well, an awful lot of us have sedentary jobs, and we sit there at our job or watching television or just spend most of the day sitting.
Blair works at the University of South Carolina and headed a study looking at adult men and their risk of dying from heart disease. He calculated how much time the men spent in their cars, at their desk, in front of the TV.
And those who were sitting more were substantially more likely to die.
Despite the fact that many of them routinely exercised, Blair says scientists are just beginning to learn about the risks of a mostly sedentary day.
If you're sitting quietly, your muscles are not contracting, except perhaps those you're using to type on your computer. But the big muscle groups, like in your legs and back and so forth, are sitting there pretty quietly.
And because the muscles aren't moving, metabolism slows down.
When we look at waist circumference, we look at triglycerides, we look at fasting blood glucose, we're finding that people who sit more have less desirable levels,
which increases the risk of diabetes, heart disease, and a number of health problems.
We just aren't really structured to be sitting for such long periods of time, and when we do that, our body kind of goes into shutdown.
Dr. Tony Yancey specializes in health promotion at UCLA's School of Public Health. For years, she's worked on developing programs to motivate people to get up and move, even while they're at their desks.
Sitting on a ball rather than a chair. As a matter of fact, that's what I'm doing right now. And, you know, it kind of helps you strengthen your core. It helps you with your balance and flexibility.
And try to take a 10-minute exercise break, like a brisk walk twice a day. Or, as Yancey says, just get up every so often and stretch.
We can put in a prompt in our computer to encourage us to stand up every hour and just move around a little bit.
It may not sound like much, but one Australian study found that these types of mini breaks, just 1 minute long throughout the day, actually made a difference. Just standing up and moving, like taking a step, marching in place every hour or so, actually lowered blood sugars, triglycerides, cholesterol, and even waist size.
If there's a fountain of youth, it probably is physical activity. So the problem is not whether it's a good idea. The problem is how to get people to do more of it.
Patty Namond, NPR News.
Let's get physical, physical. I want to get physical. Let's get into physical. Let me hear your body talk.
I'm Richard Knox, and I have a personal story about the bad things that can happen when you're inactive. A few months back, I injured my foot when I started to run again after several years of not running. Dr. Bridget Quinn, an orthopedic specialist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, prescribed physical therapy. Recently, I went back to her for a checkup.
Hi.
Hi.
Good to
Sorry
see you.
For the delay.
No, no problem. Just glad to see you.
So, Mr. Knox, how are you feeling?
Well, my left heel's okay. It doesn't hurt anymore. It took a while, but the physical therapy seemed to do the trick. But lately, I've been having knee pain that seemed to come out of nowhere. So, oh, see, there it is.
All right. Will you mind if we take a look?
Yeah, sure.
All right.
Dr. Quinn says I have a common knee condition. It's an irritation of the cartilage that lines the kneecap.
This type of knee problem is actually the most common cause of knee pain I see in all age groups. If you're a 16-year-old female distance runner, if you are a 40-year-old mother, this is the most common cause of knee pain.
It can be either an overuse problem or an underuse problem. In my case, it's clearly underuse.
I think what's happening here is that this tight tissue on the outer part of your knee is tugging your kneecap into a little bit of an abnormal alignment. It's causing the kneecap to maltrack.
It's supposed to be what, in a groove?
Yeah, it glides in a groove, but it likes to glide perfectly in that groove.
But to my enormous relief, she says this is treatable. It's not the inevitable decline of old age. It's just a problem that needs physical therapy.
Your physical therapist is going to be your personal trainer. You want someone who's familiar with this diagnosis working with you initially, and then have them graduate you to your own program.
What kind of time course is realistic for getting me past this problem?
I would suspect that in the next 6 to 8 weeks, you're going to be back on a good running program.
This is great news. I never thought I'd be able to run again. Dr. Quinn sends me to a can-do physical therapist. Her name is Poppy Jenna Corris.
Right up, please.
When I met her, she was working with a 45-year-old man named Bob Rothiker.
I'm in banking. I support corporate communications, media relations, and risk and compliance.
So you're at a desk much of the time?
Most of the time, yeah.
Like a lot of Jenna Corris's patients, staring for hours at a computer screen with terrible posture was causing Rothiker a lot of problems.
By the afternoon, it was really painful from the upper back. It would migrate to the chest area and then the shoulder area.
But 7 weeks of physical therapy has made a big difference.
It's great. I mean, I'm almost symptom-free now. That's been a tremendous help.
Jenna Corris examines me and agrees with Dr. Quinn, my problem is not just in my knee.
It's actually the mechanics of the entire lower extremity from your core all the way down to your feet. And you have to address all of those things in order to correct the problem.
Major makeover.
Major makeover.
Gosh. So what do we do?
So from what Bridget found and from what I just see, you need a program of flexibility in your hamstrings, quad strengthening, hip strengthening, and core strengthening.
It's actually not as bad as it sounds. She prescribes about a dozen different exercises that will loosen and strengthen my leg muscles.
You're going to lie on your side, so you're just going to raise your leg up and down, up and down.
So how many of these?
10 repetitions.
It should take me about an hour a day, but I've got to be faithful about it. Jenna Corris says a lot of her patients expect to stay active into their 50s, 60s, and beyond. Their parents had different expectations.
I really just think if something hurt them, they just stopped doing it. I also don't think that they sat as much as we do. We commute more, we sit at a desk more, we're on computers more.
So there it is. We're more sedentary in our everyday lives, but we expect to stay active. As my knees can tell you, that doesn't work. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston.
Run, 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 run.
And that's all for Your Health. We had production assistance from Adam Cole.
And our health blogger is Scott Hensley, who is on vacation this week, but you can see all the newest blog posts or browse through our archives at npr.org/shots.
Thanks for listening, and remember, keep moving.
Yeah, you're better off.